The sixth chapter of Mark's gospel is unparalleled drama. As I mentioned, we've been moving through it for some weeks now. It is fast-moving, it is startling with the unexpected, it is filled with love and hate, it is suspenseful, all that we expect of good drama, even in our fast-moving time. It begins with Jesus returning home to Nazareth. He teaches and preaches in the synagogue in Nazareth. He amazes the people there, but his friends and family take offense at him and at what he says. His disciples are ready to try their wings, so Jesus sent them out two by two, teaching from village to village. Then the story is interrupted because there's another one that needs to be told. Back in Jerusalem, John the Baptizer is in Herod's prison, and he is executed there. A gruesome tale of intrigue and lust and politics. And accompanying this story are the rumors of who Jesus is and what he's up to. Could he be possessed by John's spirit, they are asking. But back to the other story. Jesus' disciples return to him with reports of their experiences, filled with good news about what they have seen and what they have done on their missions. Mark reports that they had been so busy and so many people were coming and going around Jesus, they didn't have time to talk with each other. They didn't have time even to eat. So Jesus, needing some time for himself and some attention to devote to his followers, some time to eat, some time to rest, invited them to accompany him to a quiet place. They got in a boat to go across the lake for some solitude and rest. It didn't quite work out that way, though, because the Lake of Galilee is not all that large, and when the people saw Jesus and his followers getting into a boat, they guessed where they were going, they started out on foot, and they beat them to the other side. And it was a huge crowd, Mark tells us, 5,000 men, to say nothing of women and children. The story continues with Jesus feeding the crowd, 5 loaves and 2 fish, one of the most familiar stories in the gospel to us. And then the sixth chapter concludes with Jesus walking on the water as the disciples cross the lake again. And he follows that with some teaching and healing in the region surrounding Gennesaret on the other side of the lake. So you see what I mean about Mark's sixth chapter being filled with action and drama. I want you to have in mind for a moment the full scope of all that was going on in this part of Jesus' life. He was rejected at home. He sends out his disciples. John is beheaded and rumors about Jesus abound. He tries to get away with his disciples, but is followed by a huge crowd whom he teaches and feeds. Finally, across the lake again, there's walking on water and more teaching. Hold in your mind for a moment all that was going on, all that was happening to Jesus, all that was going on with him personally and around him in the immediate vicinity. His disciples return to him in need of counsel and guidance. People come to him in such numbers and with such frequency that he doesn't even have a chance to stop and eat. Rumors about him, frightening rumors, dangerous rumors are spreading through the community. The huge crowd presses upon him. They are demanding and they are hungry. How would you react to all of that? If that were happening to you, how would you react? Do you ever have busy days or busy weeks like that? How does it affect you? When you've been hard at work, a frustrating, long, tiring, taxing week, finally you come home on Friday afternoon and you fall down into your chair, you lean back and put up the footrest. And then one of the kids comes to you and says, "Dad, don't you remember this is the afternoon that you promised to?" Or your spouse comes to you and says, "You know, today is the day that you really have to finish up what you've been putting off for so long." How do you respond? Or maybe it's 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock at night and you come home and you fall into bed exhausted, the last drop of energy drained from your body, the last ounce of compassion drained from your heart. And as soon as your head hits the pillow and you feel the soft warmth of that pillow, the phone rings. And it's never good news when the phone rings at that hour. How do you respond? How do you react when that happens to you? And it happens to all of us sometime or another, sooner or later. How do you react to something like that? This is one of the things that enlarges my respect and my awe for Jesus because of how he reacted and he responded in such situations. Mark is very careful to tell us how Jesus reacted. Let me read that verse for you again. They went away in a boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. As he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he and his disciples jumped back in the boat and went to another place just to get away from them. No, that's not what it says. It doesn't say that he went out and he saw the crowd and he told them to get out of there. He needed some peace and quiet. It says he saw a great crowd and he had compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Still, he had compassion on them. And this, I suggest to you, this is the focus of all the drama. This is what is really happening in Mark's sixth chapter that we need to hear and understand and take into ourselves. Because I think this is the greatest miracle of Jesus' life and ministry. Despite all he faced, the dangers and the demands, despite all he faced, the hunger and the weariness, despite all he faced, the fears and frustrations, he had compassion on them. He has compassion on us. I like the ancient legend of a monk who found a precious stone, a valuable jewel. As he was traveling, a fellow traveler met up with him. He said he was hungry and wondered if the monk had any provisions he could spare. When the monk opened his bag, the traveler saw the valuable jewel at the top of his pack, and on an impulse, he asked the monk if he could have the valuable jewel. Amazingly, the monk gave the traveler the stone. And he departed quickly then, forgetting all about his hunger, so excited to have this valuable stone. He left overjoyed with his possession. However, a few days later, he came back, searching for that same traveling monk, and he returned the stone to him and made a request. "Please," he said, "give me something more valuable, more precious than this stone. Please give me that which enabled you to give me this valuable gift." Jesus had compassion on them. In John's telling of the story, as I mentioned to you, this is a story, the only miracle story told in all four Gospels. In John's telling of the story, he points out the fact that many who had gathered around Jesus, many who had pursued him around the lake, did so for the wrong reason. They wanted more miracles. They wanted bigger miracles. All the while, they missed the biggest miracle of them all. Jesus' compassion. None of the rest of it stacks up to that, then or now. I've seen people rejected at home and lots of other places too, labeled crazy and offensive. It's happened to me. It's happened to you too. The picture of John being beheaded hardly causes us to cringe anymore with the murder and the mayhem we have seen in our lifetime and that we continue to see every night on television. Rumors don't surprise us either. We're awash in them. And do you ever struggle to have time to sit and relax and talk, even to eat a meal with your family? If you have paid attention to what American farmers can do, the miracle of feeding the multitudes has come to pass in our generation too. None of those things that we read about in Mark's sixth chapter, none of those things surprise us anymore. None of those things are terribly out of the ordinary for us. But there is one thing that we don't see in large enough abundance. In the midst of all this, the greatest miracle lies hidden and barely noticed, the miracle of compassion, that he, with everything else going on, still had compassion for the multitudes gathered there. Don't worry about walking on water and feeding 5,000 people. If we could reproduce the miracle of Jesus' compassion among us, all the rest would be cared for. In one of the many books that he wrote, Henry Nouwen told of a visit he made to Capitol Hill in Washington, where he called on Senator Hubert Humphrey to ask him about, of all things, compassion in politics. The senator, some of you may remember, Senator Humphrey was thought in those days to be one of the most caring people in the political arena. When they sat down together, and Henry Nouwen asked Senator Humphrey about compassion in politics, he picked up a pencil from his desk, a long pencil, Father Nouwen said, with a small eraser on the end, just like the pencils that you and I use every day. And he said, "Look at this pencil. Just as the eraser is only a small part of the pencil and is used only when you make a mistake, so compassion is only called upon when things get out of hand. The main part of life is competition. Only the eraser is compassion. It is sad to say, but in politics, compassion is just a part of the competition." Perhaps Senator Humphrey expressed our condition more generally, not just in politics, but throughout life. The compassion that we have in us is like the small, soft eraser at the end of a long pencil. And we lack the long, broad compassion to cover the multitudes as Jesus had. We have just a little for some individuals and some circumstances. A miner gets caught underground and it evokes compassion. A student breaks down under the pressure of exams and we are compassionate. A single mother struggles to feed and clothe her children, and for her we are compassionate. A family whose soldier's son is captured and killed in Iraq evokes compassion. But Jesus' compassion was larger for all those mothers who could not feed their children, for all those families in every nation whose children have died, for all of those who face danger and distress, whether they are like us or not, whether they're on our side or not. Like sheep without a shepherd are we all, and God cares for us, has compassion on all of our distresses. But there's more to it than that. Do you remember the story? Another gospel story that you know incredibly well. It's told in the 25th chapter of Matthew, and it's a picture of the end of all things. And all the nations of the earth, it says, are gathered before Jesus, and it's time for judgment. And you remember how the story goes? He separates them, the sheep from the goats, and the sheep are on his right hand and the goats are on his left. And to those on his right, you remember what he says? "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the beginning." This, my friends, is God's judgment upon us. This is God's reward for us. And listen, "For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me." Remember that story? Very familiar one. And the message of that story is this: all of your life will be judged by God. And you will be judged for how compassionate you are. You see, it's not about right doctrine or good theology. It's not about personal piety or sexual ethics. It's not about church attendance or Bible reading. It's about compassion. And how you care for God's people in need, using the energy and the resources which God has given you. Compassion is not about how you feel. It's about what you do. That's what God's judgment is all about. That's how we will be held accountable for how compassionate we are, for how compassionate we have been. You know, I've been watching over the past few weeks, as you have, with great distress, all that has been going on in the Mideast, particularly in Israel and Lebanon, and the attacking that's going on, the missiles and the bombs are heartbreaking, and the people being killed, the children, the people in ambulances, United Nations peacekeepers, all of them suffering and being killed in that seemingly intractable conflict. And that, on top of the conflict that we are involved in Iraq, I wonder how many of you have thought, as I have, about some of the biblical images of that kind of conflict, and the name that goes with them, of course, is Armageddon. You know, that image late in the New Testament is a powerful one of destruction and death and the end of history. And you know, are we at that place? I don't know. We just might be. But it interests me that when we think of God's destiny for us, what we are headed for, and God's great dream for us, I know that throughout my life, it's Armageddon that we talk about. It's the end of history. It's that harsh ending, that devastating judgment from God that we hear. But I want to suggest to you that that's not what God has in mind for us. That Armageddon and that kind of an end is not what God's hope and dream for us is. Not what God's plan is. And you don't have to look far for it in the Scripture, either New Testament or Old. But we tend to overlook it in favor of the more riveting images like Armageddon. Let me read to you a couple of verses from the 65th chapter of Isaiah, one of those Old Testament prophets. And we don't hear much from Isaiah's 65th chapter. There are other chapters that are much more familiar to us. But the prophet, right at the end of all that he had to say, he set down part of what God's dream for us is, what God's hope for us is. And this is what it sounds like, God's vision for our world. No more shall there be an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person that does not live a lifetime. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be. And my chosen will long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear their children for calamity. For they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord. All of this comes about, this marvelous vision that God has, this great dream that God has for us, all comes about, of course, because God stands over Jerusalem and waves his magic wand to make everything right with the world. Of course not. All of this comes into being. They shall not labor in vain or bear their children for calamity. All of this comes to be because God's people, made whole and holy by Jesus' compassion, made whole and holy by the Holy Spirit's power, because God's people transform the world in just these ways, by being compassionate and living compassionately. When we choose Armageddon, it's not because that's God's desire or God's destiny for us, but because it is what we choose for ourselves and our world. Like the people who walked with Jesus, we focus on Jesus' miracles and we tend to notice the things that he did in the physical world. Healing the sick, multiplying food, walking on water. But Jesus' greatest miracles were in the realm of the Spirit. The offer of forgiveness for those who executed him. Love for those who hated him. Compassion for those who would not leave him alone. We possess, you and I possess in miraculous measure, the ability to heal the sick, feed the hungry, and manipulate the physical world to our advantage. But Jesus' compassion, that which he applied not just to one person or another, but to all people, becomes more miraculous to us as each day passes. This is our mission and our calling, to embody Jesus' compassion for the world, to work cooperatively with God so that God's great dream of wholeness and joy for all God's people will come into being. This is the destiny which God desires for us. Let First Church continue to lead the way. Continue to lead the way in love and compassion with the strength and conviction that are yours, great gifts from God. Amen.